we learn early in life that the world is not safe, and so we have to show up in different ways to protect the true us. So we put this armor around ourselves. And the point of the Enneagram, what I loved, is not only does it uncannily tells us about ourselves, but it also gives that kind of reminder of, oh wait, this is my defense pattern. I don't have to respond this way. I can realize that that's a reflex, and I have to sit sometimes in the uncomfortable emotions, and that's okay, because life is a span of emotions and I can grow as a human being that way.
Hi everyone, welcome to the latest episode of the Good to Growth podcast on Nonprofit Hub Radio. I'm Katie Apple, the Executive Director of Nonprofit Hub and Do More Good. Each episode of the Good to Growth podcast is designed to give you, our listener, ideas and inspiration to move your organization from good to growth. In every episode, we feature a thought leader who is working in or with the nonprofit sector to do more good. I want to pose a question to you, and I want you to realize this is probably the most important question you'll hear today, possibly this week. What if you're exactly the leader that you need to be? You heard me right. What if you're exactly the leader that you need to be? As a sector, we are plagued by self-doubt, things like imposter syndrome and second-guessing. We so often turn to great resources, awesome resources, but we assume they're one size fits all, and they're not. Today, we're going to talk to Mark Pittman. Mark is an author, he's a researcher, he's a teacher at heart, and he's a fundraising coach. He recently authored the book, The Surprising Gift of Doubt, Using Understanding to Become the Exceptional Leader That You're Meant to Be. Now, I was so struck by this title because of the word doubt. I know this is something I struggle with, and I am almost certain I'm not alone. I think you're going to find Mark's perspective and his wisdom both refreshing and very encouraging. So if you need a boost, if you need a little pick-me-up today, hang around. We'll talk to Mark shortly. Today's podcast is sponsored by Kessel Strategies. Of all the concerns nonprofit executives are faced with, one almost always goes unmet. The need for unbiased advice and hard truths to help them make the best decisions for their organization. This is why Kessel Strategies has created peer group executive sessions for nonprofit executives who feel alone at the top and who desire unvarnished dialogue and guidance on how to lead better. To learn more and join, visit nonprofitexecutiveclub.com. That's nonprofitexecutiveclub.com. Mark Pittman, former Cause Camp MC, speaker, author, speaker at the Nonprofit Storytelling Conference. I've had kind of like a fan crush on you for a while, Aww. And now I'm interviewing you on this podcast. It's exciting. It was interesting. Yesterday, I was on LinkedIn, and Katie Lord from Proof Positioning, who is someone I deeply respect, a dear friend, amazing colleague in the nonprofit sector, wrote the most beautiful review for your new book. And I have to say it got me jazzed about today's interview. It made me even more excited.
That got me jazzed too, because we weren't connected on LinkedIn. So that was totally, it just showed up in my feed. It was, I love when that happens.
So I'm familiar with you, but let's inform the audience. Give us a little bit about your background, kind of how you came to be the author of this new book.
Well, thank you. Yeah. My wife always says I give $10 answers when people want 10 cent answers. So I won't start with I was born at a young age. My parents' names were mom and dad, but I've always been around nonprofits and leadership. Those are the two things I've been around. My parents were always volunteering and taking me to do things. And we always had different leadership opportunities. So when I get out of college and was hungry because Starbucks all of a sudden wasn't paying the bills, I thought it was going to. I'm a coffee nerd. But that wasn't good for a young couple. I get a job at a college and almost immediately after a couple of years in admissions, fell into fundraising and just loved asking for money and found that the coaching that I got help me be a better fundraiser because it's about values and mission and my style and being having greater empathy and awareness about the other people that I'm working with and the donors. So all that came to a head where in 2003, I was able to start fundraisingcoach.com because I went Franklin Covey certified executive coach, had my master's in organizational leadership. And then for the next almost 15 years, people would ask me what I did. And I would answer them. I said, I'm an executive coach. And they'd say, oh, okay. And then they'd get this kind of curious look on their face, like, what does that mean? So what do you do? And then, coaching is so wonderfully not about the coach. It's about the client, the other person, that it sounds like you're selling snake oil or something. So the surprising gift of doubt is the answer to what I do. It shows that the book was one of those. It became, at first, was a keynote. I worked with my friend Neen James, who helped me develop some contextual models, and then Tamsin Webster, who helped me actually clarify it in ways people can understand. And I knew I was onto something when I shared the core concepts of the book with the client, and he immediately rephrased it back to me in his own words, and told me where he was at on the journey. It was a brilliant. That's when I knew finally I have something. That and my wife saying, looking at one of the models, saying, so where'd you get this? So I created it. No. Yeah, right. Where did you get it, Mark? I really made it because she could see herself
to keep you humble.
Oh, I married so well. So she could see herself in the journey too. So that one of the models is about the typical growth cycle or leader journey for a leader, but she could see herself in it, and she wouldn't consider herself the same type of leaders I'm coaching, but it was really cool to see that we hit on something that was going to have a bigger impact than we could have expected or hoped for.
The title, I mean, just having the word doubt in the title, I think catches 99% maybe of the sector. But the subtitle, so using uncertainty to become the exceptional leader you're meant to be. I mean, who doesn't want to do that? Because I mean, uncertainty is, I think, the plague right now.
I did struggle with putting doubt on the title because it's for CEOs, it's for profits and nonprofits. And I was trying to picture a high powered CEO sitting in first class of an airplane. Do they want doubt facing out from them if they're not reading on a Kindle or an ebook, if they're reading the book? So I'm going to get some goofy videos of like duct tape, where I have doubt sized duct tape so you can cover that and write with Sharpie whatever you want. And those, did you ever, I don't know if you went to public school, but our Catholic school, we had to put paper bags. We had to cut paper bags up and cover our books and build covers. Did you ever have it? No. Okay.
No.
So there's a way that you can fold it up, kind of like you're folding a note in class. You fold it up and you protect your book so you can return it at the end of the year without any damage.
So yeah. You're going to have a book sleeve that says like, I know what the heck I'm doing.
And right. And it'll be like fill in a blank, or that's even better. I like that. Yeah. I got this.
Yeah. That's great. I think the reason I'm drawn to it, I mean, I think about nonprofit leaders, and I even think about myself, you know, nonprofit, Hub and Do More Good, we're a nonprofit, but you have a board who's telling you what to do. You have donors telling you what to do. You have spouses telling you what to do sometimes.
Yeah.
But even the context of a nonprofit organization, because so often there's volunteers, there's staff that, you know, maybe has been there since the inception.
True.
You have a lot of voices speaking into your leadership and your leadership style. Who isn't going to have doubt?
Well, and that, so the scary thing though, I think from this was a kind of after 15 years, now it's almost 20 years of leadership coaching, seeing that this is so common and seeing that everybody thinks that they're struggling with it themselves. They really don't understand that everybody else has this, because it's not safe to express that doubt for a few reasons. One, people need to have some confidence in their leader. You want to stay employed if you can. So you don't want to cause unnecessary red flags. But also, it's not safe. Like you said, all those different people that are having their opinions are not necessarily the most healthy individuals. And we aren't, I mean, not that we're healthy all the time either, but it isn't always, some people are gunning for you. They're trying to take pot shots at you. So you have to have a shrewdness in where you share that doubt. And it's typically not out in public. So leaders are walking around looking like they have it all together. And you're internally thinking, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just making this up. But everybody else seems to have it together. So that's one of the reasons I was so glad to have that out there. When I'm giving this talk in person, I can kind of feel it in virtual, but when I'm giving it in person, it is so powerful how the room atmosphere changes when they realize it's not just me. You know, like there's this just release of shoulders and a sigh that fits the room, and people just show up and they get vulnerable in really weird ways. We did, and not weird, but weird for a business setting, but wonderful ways.
So talk to me a little bit about, you describe in the book these four quadrants, and I mean, that made so much sense to me. Talk about those four quadrants, and then talk about why we only hang out in two of them most of
the time. Okay, absolutely. And this is the one, this is the first one that I shared with my wife. She's like, where'd you get this? So if you're not driving a car, if you think of it, get a piece of paper and draw four axes. So you have four quadrants. The vertical axis is your confidence axis. It starts confident at the top, unsure at the bottom. And then the horizontal axis is your input axis. So you have external on one side and internal on the other. What I have found in working with leaders is that most of us don't realize there's a map. We go into leadership and we just think everybody else must know something that we don't know. So we start typically in the same place, high confidence and looking externally. We start in the observe quadrant where we just look to see what other people have done. We've seen coaches, we've seen teachers, we've seen parents, bosses. So we try to do what they've done. And for some it works, but often invariably there's a point there where it doesn't work. So one of the things I learned growing up is if you're leading and you turn around and there's no one following you, you're just out for a walk. And okay, that takes a hit on your confidence. So you go down the axis, you still look externally, but we are so trained, at least in the Western culture. I'm really intrigued to find indigenous styles of leadership because I think they're more inclusive and holistic than the Western culture. But in the Western culture, we look to see what the deficiency is. So it may be that we're an introverted leader who's only seen extroverted bosses and we're just spent because they go around and generate energy and be fed by that. And we're trying to go around and nobody's responding to us the same way and we're just exhausted. So we're trying to figure out maybe how to manage our time or how to motivate people or how to cast vision. And that's where we move into that second quadrant of unsure, but still looking externally. So we go to podcasts, conferences, certifications, degrees, and most leaders, I posit that's the only half the map, but we don't know that. And so many leaders can have success there, but many of them are just lurching from kind of fix to fix. I read this goal setting book and it didn't really work. I read Getting Things Done and I only get this much out of it. And so we learn, you know, even organizations, they lurch from one management profiles or, you know, management in a box thing to another. So, that's where that doubt just keeps compounding. Because if this didn't work and it worked for everybody else on the book cover said it worked for them and it's not working for me, I must be more broken than I thought I was. This is awful. What I think is a real gift of that is it could mean that you're broken and we have many more tools than we've ever had in human history to help us with that. But that doubt could finally force us over into finding the other half of the map. It could move from why do I lack so much to, what if I'm exactly the leader this organization needs? What if our organization is exactly the voice that this sector needs to have? And that's where we move into the other half of the map. We start looking at our internal cues. And quadrant three, which is analyzed, we start figuring out, all right, we typically don't respond well to this type of stimulus or this type of plan. Why? And you start developing some cues, finding out about yourself, finding out personally, I'm an introvert. They're an extrovert. Oh, I need to have some procedures. And it's not inappropriate for me to ask people to actually have an agenda when they come and meet with me or get on my calendar. That's better for them and it's better for me. And that starts building our confidence back up to the fourth quadrant, which I call the focused quadrant, which I struggled with because it's not like, blissful, you know, angelic choruses. Whoa, we're so focused. Because it's still human beings on planet Earth. There's still a lot of stuff that happens. But you have a bigger view now. You can see the whole map. You know, do I need to find a mentor or someone to copy? Do I need to find a degree or some certification or something or assessment? Or is it something internally that I need to look at myself? Is this a habitual response that I'm just reacting to and I need to distance myself? And that gives you the poise to also work with your team and find out where are they? Because each of the quadrants have benefits to them. And so you have that focus of knowing, you know where you can kind of shift and how to respond when different things come at you.
So are you nervous at all about all the magic pill books and coaches and things that you are now putting out of business?
Well, I hadn't thought about it that way. Thanks, Katie.
Honestly, I mean, that's part of what comes to mind, because I mean, it's the industry I work in, and there's a new magic pill, one solution wonder every single week. And I mean, I've felt that. I've read the books. I'm like, okay, but still I'm struggling. I love this. I love that you're kind of recognizing how diverse we all are. And there is no one personality type that is a great leader.
Isn't that the beautiful thing? I firmly have believed that there are some people clearly that can lead more naturally, but I think we can all grow into it. And for everyone listening, the way I define leadership is influencing others. So it could be a title, but there are a lot of influencers that aren't necessarily on social media or have a title. But they get people to do things. And so I think we all have exercise leadership. And I agree with you. I think all of us can be good leaders. It just will look different. And that's exciting. That's not scary.
That is exciting. So you also talk quite a bit in the book about, you talk about the Enneagram and the DISC assessment, and how do those tools come into play? How do they help us to identify who we are as a leader?
Well, thank you. Because in quadrant three, there are about a dozen tools that I share, and it's the stuff I use with my coaching clients. And I have found assessments are a quick way into that, building empathy for people if they're done right. If they're done poorly, they become these confining, constricting things of, oh, you can't possibly do that because you're not an extrovert, so you can't be a good leader. Or I can't possibly do that because I'm a people person. I could never fill in my major donor reports.
It can become a crutch too. I mean,
absolutely. Yeah.
I remember somebody like doing some pretty nasty things, and their excuse was, I'm a D. That's how I behave. You have to learn to accommodate this. And I remember.
Right. I just had somebody say that too. That's just how I am. I just come across that way. Well,
yeah.
It's doing damage. So it's your choice. Keep doing damage. I had one D that said, when I did a DISC one, which is, so for everybody listening, that's an ancient Greek model of four different categories of people. DISC I like because there's no emotional attachment to the words, to the letters. D's are the extroverted or the really active task-centered people. So they bulldoze through things. I had one person say in a training, thanks. I just want to let you know, typical D, like in the middle of the training, I want to let you know that I know you say it's all task and I am identified with the D, but I actually have really good people skills too. And so I was just quiet because as a coach, you learn to just let silence, even if it's a large audience. I said, well, I'm glad for that. And I'm glad for your team, but I'd encourage you before you just accept that about yourself, check in with your team members to see if they feel your good social skills, if they're experiencing them. And I had every single member of that man's team come up to me afterwards and one-on-one, like, thank you. He doesn't get it at all.
We all have blind spots.
We all have blind spots. And that's why I like the assessments. Enneagram is another one. So Enneagram talks about how there's nine different types of stories that we tell ourselves to protect ourselves. We learn early in life that the world is not safe. And so we have to show up in different ways to protect the true us. So we put this armor around ourselves, and it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, or 9 is the types. And then they have people give various labels to them. But the point of the Enneagram, what I loved is not only does it, for those of us that like it, it uncannily tells us about ourselves, but it also gives that kind of reminder of, oh, wait, this is my defense pattern. I don't have to respond this way. So for me as a 7, reframing things and making everything positive and moving to the future because I'm afraid of the dark emotions of like mundane life, let alone depression, like all of that is really awful for me. So I'm just trying to run ahead of any negative or boringness. I can realize that that's a reflex and I have to sit sometimes in the uncomfortable emotions, and that's okay. Because life is a span of emotions and I can grow as a human being that way.
Thank Thank you to Kessel Strategies for making today's podcast possible. Nearly 50% of nonprofit leaders are operating without a strategic plan. This means their efforts are largely unfocused and reactionary. Kessel Strategies helps growth-minded leaders gain control of their destiny by refocusing their strategic priorities. The team at Kessel Strategies facilitates exclusive programs where nonprofit executive directors and CEOs can learn from and engage with their leadership peers. Want strategic clarity? Visit nonprofitexecutiveclub.com. So if you are just joining us, we are with Mark Pittman. Mark has recently released a new book, The Surprising Gift of Doubt, Using Uncertainty to Become the Exceptional Leader You're Meant to Be. So talk to us more about building our own kind of custom track for leadership.
This is where the coaching part starts sounding a little squirrely, because consultants come in with a plan, step one, step two, step three, step four, which is, there are times for that. As a coach, I try to go with where the person is. And so the first step could be any of the tools. We've talked about the different assessments. What's nice about them is that they're online. They give a language. They feel like, I feel seen, or I don't feel seen. And so that can be a good discussion too. Another place that a lot of people seem to find, especially as we're in whatever phase of this pandemic we're in, is doing a values indicator or a value sorter. And if you Google values sorter, you'll find a bazillion on the web. I've got one at conquerleadershipgroup.com/values. My friend Brent Manswar has one at feedyoursheep.com, because he talks about your core values being the black sheep, because those are the sheep that whose wool can't be colored. They're the indelible wool. So those are like your core values. Don't change. But doing them, it's usually a bunch of words, and then you've kind of find the ones that kind of speak to you, and you try to limit it down to 10 or better still, 5. And then it can help you realize that other people value other parts of this. And so you can start figuring out, how does that influence my leadership? For me, I remember doing this with the Franklin Covey training, and it was independence was one of my words, and I didn't realize that. But if I'm trying to build a team and one of my core values is independence, I have to choose to subjugate my independence to the team, or create structures that will, maybe the gift I can bring to the team is that it'll help everybody be more independent and think on their own. And, you know, there's different ways you can look at your values, but you want to make sure that you're intentionally looking at them and letting them shape, or choosing if they're the right things to shape your style.
So for nonprofit leaders who are looking to make a change, they're looking to go to a new organization, is that something they should have as kind of a litmus test, that their own values are reflected in the core values of the organization?
This is an excellent question. We just talked about this with I'm doing a coach certification course now. I'm offering a coach certification, my first quadrant or first cohort of me teaching others how to be coaches. And that was exactly the question they had too, was should I look for overlapping? Should I look for the same values? I think it's that you're even having that question. And I think what you can do if you're looking at another organization is ask other people, what would you say the core values of this organization are? Not the ones on the boardroom wall, but like, what would you say the values are? The more times I've done this with leaders, the more times they can't tell me, particularly mid-level managers, they can't tell me what their organization's values are, because it's usually crisis and putting out fires and overwhelm and chaos. There's not space for that. But one of the leaders, and I think I talk about her, who came to our intensive, realized joy was one of the values that she deeply resonated with and wanted to be on her department to be reflecting joy. But she said, the time to just reflect on that herself, realized there was nothing in the last quarter that would tell her team members, this is a fun place to be. This is a joyful place to be. Because she was so all about statistics and systems and all these other things that are necessary and good, but she wasn't creating space to actually kind of nurture, to water those flowers.
I so get that. And you, I mean, you're right. It's tyranny of the urgent.
So what I do, I don't know how you do this, but what I do is I have a manifesto that I've written for my company. And I use a thing called followupthen.com. followupthen.com. It's a free email service. And every Tuesday it comes into my inbox just to remind me. And as I bring on new people, I'll also be able to bring that. Because one of the worst things that happens with manifestos, value statements, mission statements is that we do them, strategic plans, and then we put them up on a shelf or let them sit, you know, gather digital dust on a shared drive. I know I respond well to, one of the things I've learned is email is a response mechanism for me. Like I pay attention to stuff in email more than to-do lists. So just have it come into my inbox. I don't have to read the whole thing every time. It's about a page, maybe two, but I can pick out different things. And it reminds me and inspires me about, oh yeah, that's right. That's what I say I believe. That's what I aspire to do, or that's what I really do.
Followupthen.com. I will make sure that's in the podcast notes.
Yeah. And there's all sorts of different ways you can configure that. I also have every evening at about 4:30, I say, what are the three important things I want to do tomorrow? It gets inbox, it's sent to my inbox. So it doesn't mean that they always work. But at least I have systems to help me be the me that I want to be. So something about values, as people are thinking about values, if one of the things to think about is core and aspirational, and this is where Brant Mansour with his Black Sheep values helped me. Core values are values that you can look back into your life and say, I have a story about how I lived that out. Aspirational values tend to be values that don't have a track record yet for you. There's something that happened in the future. There are things you aspire to, which is great. We all want to aspire to things. But I would say with your original question about looking for a new position, I think there's an overlap of one or two. Something that would feed one of your core values is probably really important because you're going to be committing some of the best waking of your waking hours there. So
That makes total sense. That's what I expected. So I want to know what happened, or maybe what got you to the point. I mean, we've talked a little bit. It's bold. It's a bold move to put doubt in the title. This whole book kind of is a little bit of a bold move.
Thank you.
What, in a good way, in a great way, what got you to the point? What stirred your heart to write this for nonprofits?
Part of it for me was I've always been a leadership guy, not a fundraising guy. I branded myself as fundraising coach. The implicit thing was that I was about development and money, which I'm good at and I love. My first book was Ask Without Fear. I love asking people for money and coaching people how to do that. But it's all about leadership for me. Mission, vision, values, making sure people are in the best fit that they can be in a place where they can flourish to the best of their ability, even if it's in a crazy environment. There are still things that we can do to help a little bit of flourishing happen with ourselves or with our teams. And that's what I can only talk to so many people and I can only do so much one-on-one coaching. And so writing the book was a way of trying to help other people. People keep telling me it gives them permission. To be themselves, to be different, to be a little bit quirky and see that maybe as a sellable point or as a benefit, as opposed to a bug or a defect. Life is so short. I would love more people to try to be the best that they could be. I firmly believe I want to know what I'm good at, but I also want to know what I'm limited at. Not so I can have an excuse to not do it. But so that the weird thing that you've experienced too, I'm sure, is stuff I don't like to do, people love to do. And I can let people just be in their glory and doing the stuff that makes their heart sing, even though it bores me to tears.
Yeah.
And so if I know what bores me to tears, even though there are times that I'll have to do some of those things, it's life, being able to say, could I make your day? I hate doing this. I did this with a team with a physical therapy practice and also with a horse veterinary practice where we asked, I call it the Jefferson assessment because Dave Jefferson was the guy that introduced this to me. What do you love to do? What do you hate to do? What do you want to do more of? What do you want to do less of? And where do you see yourself in the next 3 to 5 years? Leaders that can ask that of their team are remarkable because it acknowledges that most of us aren't going to be in the same place in 3 to 5 years. So how are we going to steward the employees that are with us now? How are we, the better that we can steward them with the understanding, not that we're trying to kick them out the door, but they're not going to be lifers. And that's not a bad thing. That's not a deficit. That's just how it is. And if we can get better at that, our recruitment costs will go way down because people will realize, oh, this is a place that we want to work. Because these are people that are interested in growing as well as getting work done. But the every time I've done this with teams, what I love to do and what I hate to do, somebody's hate to do is somebody else's love to do. And they can start shifting the work in their schedules and maximizing their productivity and getting even more done because they like to, like the physical therapy practice. One guy loved doing knees and the rest of the practice didn't like the knees. They wanted to do other parts of physical therapy. So they gave all the knees to him. He would get even better at it and was able to do more and help more people even more safely. Yeah, it was, it's amazing to me because we just think that we're struggling on our own and doing this by ourselves. And, More often than not, it doesn't have to be that way.
No, we don't have to fit into other people's frames. I love that. I love that.
And there are constructs. So like when I do this with staffs, I always end it with, you were an adult who accepted a position with a job description. Yeah. You made an agreement to do your job. So just as much as enlightened and as wonderful as we're trying to be here, we are in an artificial environment of work and we do have things that we have to do. I was just talking to somebody earlier. Well, I mentioned the Starbucks thing. I didn't like cleaning the toilets at Starbucks. That was not why I wanted to become in management at Starbucks, even though I never made it there. But if you're selling a diuretic, it's probably good that you have clean toilets because it will get used. So there's things that we have to do and that's just being human.
But that can help you get into the right job though. I mean, if you find that you're struggling in the position you accepted, then, you know, there's your sign.
Oh, so many of my early summer jobs were jobs I realized I don't want to do this for the rest of my life. Yeah. And it wasn't that it was, I think one of the things that it would be, it's, I like to approach things from a grace and empathy kind of perspective as opposed to a judgmental one. So it's not that it's bad that people do love it. I'm glad they do because I just wouldn't want to do that. So, and for me and in our sector, it was managing fundraisers. I like doing, and this is one stress and fundraisers have. The ones that get really good at it get promoted to management and they don't like management and they haven't been trained to do management. They just like talking to donors and getting gifts.
Like the people, I've heard that before.
Yeah. And it becomes one of the churn at the higher levels of fundraising is often that they have to do it through people, which is a very different skill set than doing it themselves.
I'm not sure if you're aware, but we recently rebranded our podcast. It used to be called the Hubcast. Nonprofit Hub. And a lot of times people thought it was an automotive podcast. So
branding is great. I love it.
And differentiating, we're calling it the Good to Growth podcast. And one of the segments we're doing every week is that we ask our guests to share some bit of good news for the sector. So something you see coming or something that gives you hope, but a bit of good news.
Wow. Two things that immediately come to mind are one, the passion of people that are coming into our sector. It's really tumultuous for leaders right now because leaders that have been in positions for a while were not raised with a work ethic that the newer people are coming in with, but especially speaking on social issues and all, or standing up for their values, not working to the bone, themselves to the bone, taking care of themselves. And so I love that. I think we're both for-profit and nonprofit are going through this incredible shift where companies are going to be forced to pay better and take care of people better, or they're going to go out of business, which isn't bad. If it's the time their life cycle for an organization is gone, that's fine. But I think there's really positive pressure and I'm really glad for that. As uncomfortable as it is for me and everybody that I, the people that are going through it on both sides, because the people that see it can't understand why the others can't see it. The other positive, I think, is that reports I've seen say that we're going to need 80,000 in the nonprofit sector alone. We're going to need 80,000 leaders a year because as leaders either retire or expire, we're going to have all these openings. And so the positive is there's never been a lot of upward trajectory. Most nonprofits are so lean and flat that there's not a lot of growth path. And I think the potential for leadership or having a leading position is more than it has been in a long time, even though it doesn't feel that when, if you're looking for an executive director, it feels like that takes forever. And if you want to be an executive director, it feels like there are no positions. So it's a weird conundrum. But Yeah, I mean, there's a huge risk in that because there's going to be a lot of untested leaders running some of our biggest and our most vital community-centered organizations. But I do think it's an exciting time for people that want to do good and support the communities that they serve.
I could not agree more. And I feel like you've given them one more resource to help them on their path. So that is a good note to end this on. Mark, thank you so much. I appreciate you taking time. I appreciate you kind of giving us a look inside the cover of the new book. And I'm excited. This is going to be one of my go-tos for new ED gifts. So.
Yay! Thank you. Yeah. That's awesome.
I hope to meet you this May at the Ultimate Nonprofit Conference, Cause Camp. You can learn more about Cause Camp by visiting cause.camp. Thanks for listening to another Good to Growth podcast. You can find more great content to take your organization from good to growth at nonprofithub.org.